Chapter 7. So how did the two of you meet? Reflecting on life's key moments. When I visit patients for the first time, it is like skipping to the very last pages of their autobiographies. It is like involuntarily cheating by seeing the end of a story first. The complete history of their life journeys, the setbacks and opportunities, the results of the decisions they have made, the records of their opinions, dreams, and wishes they have had, and of the people they have accepted and dismissed, all lie in the preceding pages. In any way I can, I try to work backwards to all the dog-eared and tattered earlier pages to best understand what their past trajectory might have been, so I can personalize the visit as much as possible. If no family members are present and the patient cannot speak, objects in the home tell this story. As I walk in, I might see a plaque conspicuously displayed near the bed proclaiming 40 years of dedicated service as an attorney, co-signed by a celebrity. I might encounter wedding portraits with a rustic background or relaxed poses of family on a cruise who look like they are there as a matter of course. Or a photo of the first great-grandchild cradled by some figure who has relegated herself to the background with only her suntanned arms in view. Handmade decorations on the mantelpiece might reveal the patient's interests or talents. I do this type of observation for myself as well as for the client. For him, so I can know best how to connect with him. For example, by talking about something he likes and is familiar with. For me, so I can experience him as a more complete human being, even if all he can do is open his eyes long enough to check out who is talking to him. I often wonder how a patient might have interacted with me if we had known each other in an earlier chapter of his life. Would we have become friends? Would he have enlightened me in some way? Meeting him at the end is humbling in any case, because I might be one of the very last people he will ever see. When patients are fully capable of communicating, I can get their life stories directly. This is important for them because this is how they can start pondering what their lives have been about and what significance it has had for them and their loved ones. The hospice lingo for this process is life review. Sometimes I will challenge them to make sense of their lives by asking, "When you look back at your life, what do you see?" More often, I take a turning point in someone's life story and go with a gentler approach, for example, by asking a couple how they first met. I asked an Orthodox Jewish couple that question and got this story from the spouse, Mrs. Goldfarb. Leaning back in her wicker chair in her outdoor patio, she said, "I had met my husband by accident. I was staying in a hotel and heard some commotion nearby. What a racket! I ran outside and saw a car right there caught in the ditch. Well, I invited the driver in to come on in and get all cleaned up. He was all messed up and everything. It was such a shame to see him like that. I felt sorry for him." Because of this kindness, the driver soon wrote out his thanks in a letter to her with his phone number included, and invited her to call him if she wanted to go out. Leaning forward to indicate a shifting emotion, she volunteered, "At first I thought he had some nerve doing that, asking me to call him. That wasn't done in my day, as you know." She looked at me intently to make sure I did in fact know. She went on, "I found out later that he did that because he would have felt embarrassed if I had said no over the phone." As Mrs. Goldfarb continued reminiscing about her husband, she added this hair-raising anecdote regarding his life in his native Germany. "My husband had quite a hard life, but was lucky. He escaped the Nazis. What happened is there was this police friend of his that warned him the Nazis were planning to come get him and his family that night. Each family member left the apartment, i.e. permanently, one at a time. I asked her, 'Why one at a time?' She answered, 'They each left 15 minutes apart so no one would notice. If they had all left at once, it would have raised the alarm.'" Perhaps Mrs. Goldfarb, as a result of this reflecting back on Mr. Goldfarb's earlier life, marveled over how such a convoluted chain of unlikely events had ever resulted in their meeting each other. A widow named Trudy responded to, "So how did the two of you meet?" with a description of the most romantic first date you could dream of. She said she first saw her husband when he was playing baseball in their high school field. He came over to her on the stands and, using the oldest line in the world, asked if he had seen me someplace before. I said no, but I sure loved your home run. When I said that, he said, "Well, I'll get another for you." And he went back to the game. That was it for a while, and oh, a long time after that, I was about to go to the movie theater, and I saw Ted coming out. So I asked him, "How'd you like the movie?" And he said, "I really don't know. I was distracted. I'll just have to go in and see it all over again. See it all over again with you." And he went in and saw the same movie all over again just to be with me. Trudy had transported herself and me decades and decades back to that first date with Ted as she lay almost immobile on a couch. A nearby blanket with presidential insignia for its subject was ready to provide comfort on a second's notice. In terms of their marriage, she definitely was Ted's first lady. Reviewing one's past can reveal what was missing, as well as what made one's life worth living. Here's a riddle. Take Saul, a patient in his own home near Hightstown. In his case, what was I able to do for him to fill in what was missing? It was the week of Hanukkah, the day I entered his home. He was in a hospital bed, smack dab in the middle of the living room, with his wife and son present. I had scarcely introduced myself when the family told me the dreary news that during that very day, they had given him morphine for the first time. Then, in no time at all, his son skipped any preliminaries and straightaway got to the heart of his father's spiritual pain. "I just want to tell you, something has troubled my father for 72 years. My father never had a bar mitzvah." His wife elaborated that because Saul's own father had died right at the time he was studying for the ceremony, it was canceled and never rescheduled. I mulled this over in my mind, wondering what out-of-whack family dynamic overruled merely postponing the big event. Why didn't they ever reschedule it? Sure enough, later in the conversation, I learned that Saul had always felt ashamed that he had never had a bar mitzvah, especially because his older brother did. I had an inspiration, and out loud I said, "You know what? If you can assemble 10 people over here, the prayer quorum needed for the ceremony, I could make him a bar mitzvah at my next visit." Instead of declaring to me that I had to be joking, they talked excitedly to one another, picturing the scene of their friends stopping by and Saul saying a prayer. His wife even jumped out of her chair and got on the phone and started calling the neighbors. In the excitement, his son almost forgot to ask Saul, who glowed as he nodded and squeezed out the word yes. Privately, I told the family we had better do part of the ceremony right now, as Saul frankly might not be conscious or even alive on another day. And that was what we did. His son trotted upstairs to bring down a prayer shawl Saul's own father had worn, along with a cup of wine. The ceremony consisted of my helping the patient recite the one blessing he remembered, which was a blessing over the wine, and then he just about managed the one ritual sip. I then recited a blessing called the priestly benediction. "May God bless you and keep you. May God's countenance shine upon you. May God's graciousness grant you the gift of peace." And after that, I cried out, "Mazel tov! You are now a bar mitzvah!" followed by a traditional song which the family clapped along to and dreamily sang. I asked if they had a camera handy, and sure enough, as good as at any reception, they snapped a pile of pictures in a mad rush. His wife then rang up Saul's older brother and put the phone by Saul's ear. I said to Saul, "Wow, here's the receiving line." Saul proudly told his brother he had his bar mitzvah, and the older congratulated the younger. Saul was now spiritually a man. As weakened as he was, he radiated sanctity and supreme joy. Moments later, I was both stupefied and amused by Saul's presence of mind to ask me what my fee would be. I replied that copies of the photographs would be payment enough, which satisfied him. I do have those photos of this Hanukkah miracle, and I treasure the bittersweet pleasure that emanates out of them. 1 week later, Saul died, having fulfilled his lifelong dream. Somehow, as in the case of Saul asking my fee, I have a way of picking up on humor no matter where I am, even while on the job. Besides the quirky stories you've already encountered in this book, the next chapter is devoted to some interactions which are more decidedly amusing.